I'm not used to such a long CV, but Gordon makes you write these up for the advertising. But I did largely spend my life doing kidney medicine and treatment of patients with chronic kidney disease and some research in bone because kidney disease affects bone. Also, obviously, if you're working in kidney disease, you become very involved and interested in ethics, as because many of these people that we're dealing with are very close to the end of life, and there are large resource allocation issues. So it's this sort of background that I bring to the talk today, and I'll just begin by reading something that I actually read only this morning. I came back from a lovely one-week holiday in Costa Rica, and just as I was putting together the papers to throw them out, I looked into the book review of the Globe and Mail from a week or so ago, and on February the 17th, there was a review of a book by a French intellectual called Michel Onfray, called In Defense of Atheism, The Case Against Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Now, Onfray is described as promoting a philosophy of hedonism, libertarianism, secularism, and an ethic based on reason, utility, pragmatism, and hedonism. And according to the author of this book, he is critical of the fact that current secular society has settled for Christian ethics without religion. It is stated that this includes the following: excellence of the family, virtues of work, need to respect one's parents and honor the old, rightness of nationalism, patriotic obligations, mistrust of the flesh, submission to political authority, and duty to the poor. And apparently he says, what could the village priest object to here? The writer of the article, Kurt Kleiner, is said to be a non-believer. He comments, the problem with this book isn't that Onfray is offensive, although religious people will find him so, but rather that he is simplistic. Kleiner states, non-believers need to challenge religion, but to make the challenge credible, they have to deal with the full reality. They need to maintain their attack on the irrationality of religion, but realize that many believers of great intelligence will disagree with them. The West is in the middle of a culture war, provoked by the upsurge of Christian and Muslim fundamentalism. Secular and religious thinkers alike debating the proper relationship between religion and society. Atheists need to join this argument, but to make a difference, they will have to make serious arguments, not frivolous provocations. And I personally would respond and say that this is the same for Christians. In this paper, The Role of Christianity in the Development and Prospect of Western Medicine, I'll attempt to provide an overview of the following. First, the important role of Judeo-Christian thought and institutions to the development of compassionate and scientific Western medicine from early Christianity through the 20th century. Second, the current situation as medical technology advances and society diverges from its Christian ethical foundations. And then thirdly, a Christian perspective on the relationship of Christian faith and Western medicine today and into the future. To begin, it's necessary to define what we mean by the term Western medicine. In his acclaimed book, The Greatest Benefit of Mankind, The Medical History of Humanity, which I must say is an outstanding book, by Professor Roy Porter, explains the use of the term Western medicine as follows. The term is not narrowly or blindly ethnocentric. But Western medicine has developed in ways that made it uniquely powerful and led it to become uniquely global. What became the medicine of Europe is becoming the medicine of humanity. The development of this Western medicine begins with Judeo-Christian and Greco-Roman antiquity and spans more than 2 millennia of history into Europe, the Americas, and beyond. For the purposes of this paper, I will propose that what we call Western medicine is characterized by three major elements. First, science-based technology. Second, professional ethics and codes. And third, compassionate care. In this paper, I will discuss the seminal role of Christianity played in the development of these elements. Now, in order to describe the role of Christianity on the development of Western healthcare, I'll begin first by considering the foundations that were laid in early Christian era, and then secondly, discuss the influence of Christianity on the development of scientific, ethical, and compassionate care from the medieval times to the 20th centuries. Three major influences shaped the healthcare beliefs and practices of the early Christians and subsequent Western medicine. These three influences were Judaic beliefs and practices, the teachings of Jesus as understood in the early Christian church, and aspects of Greco-Roman culture. The important Judaic beliefs and practices that grounded the Christian approach to medicine included at least some of the following. First of all, belief in one personal God who controlled the world, including health and illness. Second, a God who is often characterized in the Jewish scriptures as a God who heals. Third, that healing was accessed through confession and prayer and not through elaborate rituals. And when you think back into the Old Testament, you'll see that that's actually quite true. There were not elaborate rituals. There were elaborate worship rituals, but not elaborate healing rituals. And then fourth, prophetic healers were recognized in the context of Judaism, but appeal to witchcraft and pagan magic was denied. Natural remedies were also acceptable, but the healing powers were seen to be related to the beneficence of God. This understanding is exemplified by quotations from the 2nd century BCE in the apocryphal book of Ecclesiasticus, where it says, "Honor the physician with the honor due him, for the Lord created him. God is glorified through the skill he gave to men to compound medicines." According to early Christian documents, Jesus and the early church affirmed these Jewish beliefs. But as I will discuss later, Jesus also challenged some Jewish beliefs and practices. Jesus' first public recorded teaching was when he rose in the synagogue to read from the scroll of Isaiah, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor, freedom to the prisoners, recovery of sight to the blind, and release the oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Jesus then proclaimed, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing," indicating that he had come to fulfill God's promise to proclaim good news and to bring healing. Jesus instructed those he healed to go and offer thanks to God for their healing in the traditional Jewish manner. "To a healed leper," he said, "show yourself to the priest and offer sacrifice that Moses commanded for your cleansing." Jesus himself was described as a miraculous healer, representing the will of God to heal. The healing miracles are recorded in the Christian writings to be integral to the life and teaching of Jesus. Jesus and the apostles obviously accepted the role of naturalist physicians. Jesus is recorded as saying, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick." And Paul the Apostle wrote about Luke, the writer of one of the early Christian Gospels, "Our dear friend Luke, the doctor, and Demas send greetings." On the other hand, Jesus challenged some prevalent Jewish understandings and brought some new insights that became distinctive foundations of Christian thought and practice. For example, Jewish belief was that prosperity and good health resulted from obedience to God's law. There are many suggestions that recorded that Jesus did not accept this as a necessary causality. Specifically, when the disciples asked of a blind man, "Who sinned, this man or his parents?" Jesus replied, "Neither this man or his parents." Jewish practice was to exclude individuals with chronic disease from society. Jesus touched them, healed them, and gave the highest commendation to those who cared for the sick. He is recorded as saying, "Come, you who are blessed of my Father, for I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat, thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was sick, and you looked after me. Whenever you did it for one of the least of these brothers or sisters of mine, you did it for me." Perhaps the greatest example of this new direction of Jesus' teaching, the challenge of Judaism of his time, is found in the story of the Good Samaritan. The Jewish leadership was very upset that Jesus was constantly critical of them for placing a higher importance on caring for others than on keeping the Jewish law. Jesus taught that it was more important to demonstrate love of God through love of neighbor than by keeping Jewish ritual laws. And if you read the New Testament Gospels, Jesus was continually scrapping with the Pharisees over this issue, and calling them hypocrites and so forth because of the way they would keep the minute Jewish laws but neglect the care of others. It is recorded that the Jewish leadership sent a lawyer to test Jesus to have him explain what he meant by teaching to love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus explained by telling the so-called Good Samaritan story. In this story, a hated enemy of the Jews gives medical care to a stricken Jewish man, while in contrast, the Jewish religious leaders ignored the man's plight. The story would be a scandal in its time and further infuriated the Jewish leaders. However, the principle of the Good Samaritan, caring for the health of all men regardless of race or culture, became a founding principle of care in early Christianity. The underlying concept, love your neighbor as yourself, is extensively expounded in the New Testament in the writings of other apostles, including Paul. The Good Samaritan became an iconic symbol of Christian charity in the early church, and this is just exemplified by a quotation from St. Jerome, the late 4th century. "Our Lord teaches who our neighbor is in the gospel parable of a certain man going from Jerusalem to Jericho. Everyone is our neighbor. We are neighbors, all people to all people, for we have one Father." The third major influence on the Christian approach to healthcare is derived from the rapid expansion of Christianity into the Greco-Roman culture. Christians rejected pagan healing gods such as Asclepius of the Homeric tradition and Isis of the Egyptian tradition. And they rejected the associated complex healing rituals and shrines. I'm sure that any of you who have traveled into Greece or Turkey have seen these shrines, and they are very interesting indeed. However, there was an acceptance of the Greco-Roman tradition of empirical medicine that was exemplified by Hippocrates, probably starting around 400 BCE, and then later carried on by the Roman physician Galen in the 2nd century, but there were people all along the way who carried this tradition forward. This tradition emphasized the natural as opposed to supernatural theories of causes of illness, and it included empirical therapies that were based on observed results, such as dietetics, pharmacology, and surgery. To quote Roy Porter again, there were many models of healing, secular and sacred alike, in the New Testament. He states, costly physicians were condemned, but Luke the evangelist was himself a physician. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, as recorded by Luke, the use of wine as a disinfectant reflects Greek wound treatment. St. Basil, who opened a hospital for lepers in the late 300s, provides an example of an early Christian view of empirical medicine. We must take great care to employ the medical art if it should be necessary, not making it wholly accountable for our health or illness, but making it redound to the glory of God. In addition to the early church's acceptance and use of Greco-Roman empirical therapies, early Christians also recognized and adopted aspects of the ethical code of physician conduct found in the Hippocratic writings. As I will discuss later, this ethic was found to be very compatible with Christian teaching and was adopted, with some modification, into the Christian church. For example, in the late 4th century, again, St. Jerome referred to the Hippocratic Oath, stating that the oath was guidance, but how much more must we be charged with the cure of souls and love all Christians as our neighbors? In summary, then, during the early Christian era, a medley of attitudes towards healing and physical and spiritual care shaped fluid relationships between medicine, the church, and society. However, certain overarching features became the basis of Western medicine. As Roy Porter writes, Christianity made its mark through care. Greek and Roman paganism acknowledged no such duties. Sociologist Rodney Stark, in his book, The Rise of Christianity, How an Obscure Marginal Jesus Movement Became the Dominant Religious Force in the Western World in a Few Centuries, bit of a title, states that pagan and Christian writers were unanimous not only that Christian scripture stressed love and charity as the central duties of the faith, but that those were sustained in everyday behavior. He contends that one of the reasons for the increase in the Christian population relates to the care for infants, the nursing care that was associated with Christian communities, and that this commitment to care not only increased the survival of Christian communities, but attracted converts to them. I'll conclude this section by quoting Professor Albert Johnson, a prominent American medical ethicist actually based in Seattle. The very conception of medicine, as well as its practice, was deeply touched by the doctrine and discipline of the church. This theological and ecclesiastical influence manifestly shaped the ethics of medicine, but it even indirectly affected its science. As missionaries evangelized the peoples of the Western and Northern Europe, the church found itself in a constant battle against the use of magic and superstition in the work of healing. It championed rational medicine along with prayer to challenge superstition. Following then the early Christian era, the Christian church continued to have a significant influence on the scientific, ethical, and care elements of Western medicine through the next millennia, from the medieval times to the 20th century. First, I want to consider the influence of Christianity on Western science, particularly medical science. David Lindbergh, professor of history and science, University of Wisconsin, wrote in his book, The Beginnings of Western Science, "The standard answer developed in the 18th and 19th centuries and widely propagated into the 20th, and may I add, into the 21st, by such as Richard Dawkins and Michael Onfray and a number of others who are writing these days, maintains that Christianity presented serious obstacles to the advancement of science. The truth is far different and much more complicated. The renowned philosopher of science, A.N. Whitehead, stated, "Faith in the possibility of science, generated antecedently to the development of modern scientific theory, is an unconscious derivative from medieval philosophy. The origins of science required Christianity's insistence on the rationality of God." This theme was further elucidated by Richard Tarnas, a professor of philosophy and psychology from California, in his superb book, The Passion of the Western Mind. He reviews the development of science from its foundations in medieval Catholicism, including Franciscans such as Robert Gostest, the first chancellor of Oxford University, Roger Bacon, Francis Bacon, Copernicus, Galileo, Newton, Kepler, and Descartes, and he states, "The great passion to discover the laws of nature that was felt by the scientific revolutionaries derived not least from a sense that they were recovering a divine knowledge. At last the human mind comprehended God's principles." Christians who believed that nature was the handiwork but not the substance of a rational God, and that all truth was God's truth, looked for the truth, stood up for what they discovered, and became the founders of modern science. Christianity also had a major role in the development of early empirical medical science. Christians and Christian institutions were integral to the preservation and recovery of classical science. Johnson summarizes this fact as follows: "Monastic infirmarians became competent herbalists. Handbooks prepared for parish priests often included advice about medical assistance. Medicine appears to have been cultivated in a more scholarly way in the cathedral schools, precursors to the medieval universities. Bishop Philbert, founder of the Cathedral School of Chartres, appears to have been a competent medical scholar, ready to use the wisdom of Hippocrates while depending on the mercy of the Lord." A renaissance of classical medical literature based on translations from Arabic, Greek, and Latin began in the context of the church. An example of this is an 11th century Benedictine monk, Alphanus, who became the Archbishop of Salerno. He is said to have been in large part responsible for reintroducing Greek medical texts to the West and the establishment of an important medical school at Salerno. A later example is the renowned 17th century Protestant physician Thomas Sydenham, who was acclaimed as the English Hippocrates because he prized observation, avoiding speculation, and using his senses. The clinical writings of Sydenham provided significant grounding for the growth of scholarly medicine, and I will return to discuss the Christian ethical writings of Sydenham. Christians made and have continued to make important contributions in the advancement of medical science. However, it is a fact that the success of science itself and the uneasy tension that has existed and still exists between scientific discovery and church dogma caused a shift in Western perspective. As a generalization, to quote Tarnas, "The West lost its faith and found a new faith in science and in man." This understanding became starkly clear to me when one early January morning this year, My wife and I went to see Body World 3, a very popular, excellent public exhibit of anatomically dissected human beings. Many of you may have seen this. We ended up going on the last day, and they were running it for 24 hours around the clock, and the only sensible time we could find was about 6 o'clock in the morning. So we went to it. But one of the things that struck me was a quotation on the wall by Friedrich Nietzsche. "I consist of body and soul, in the words of a child. And why shouldn't we speak like children? But the enlightened, the knowledgeable would say, I am body through and through, nothing more, and the soul is just a word for something on the body. However, I would remind you that medical science was founded by those who believed that humankind consisted of much more than a body, and also that many enlightened and knowledgeable people, including healthcare providers and scientists, have grounded their framework of understanding and their motivation to serve others in a much different view of humankind. I suggested that the second important element in Western medicine is the ethical conduct codes that have characterized the health professions. As I will describe, Christianity was integral to the formation of such codes of ethics. In the case of the medical profession, the ethical codes have been grounded in the so-called Hippocratic Oath. This oath is thought to have originated about 400 BCE and is attributed to the Greek physician Hippocrates, the leader of a school of naturalistic, empirical, and theoretical medicine. The Hippocratic writings and the oath were known and cited by Roman physicians in the 1st and 2nd century, but the first full manuscript dates to about 300 CE. The Hippocratic Oath is a remarkable document. Though it reflected the religious beliefs of its time, the underlying principles are compatible with Christian thought. And the oath was adopted by the Christian Church and became a foundation of medical ethics from the Middle Ages to the 20th century. The principles of the oath are outlined. First of all, accountability. In the original oath, the accountability was to the Greek gods. Second, respect for teachers and responsibility to teach. Third, beneficence towards the ill and respect for life. Not to give deadly drugs or to use abortive techniques. Fourth was to refer to competent practitioners. Then to the primacy of patient welfare and to refrain from abuse, including sexual abuse, and then patient confidentiality. This extraordinary document was written long before the rise of Christianity and preserved in monasteries and by Islamic scholars and was rediscovered by the medieval church. I've already quoted St. Jerome's 4th century admonition to a young priest to use the oath for guidance. The oath was common in monastic texts in the 8th and 10th centuries and was seen to impose a rigorous duty on those who cared for the sick. Albert Johnson states that with the Greek divinities replaced by the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the oath represented a deontological argument congenial to Catholic physicians of the Middle Ages. Further, the deontological tone of medicine was reinforced by church canon law and held clerical and lay physicians to high moral standards. This fusion of a Hippocratic oath persisted into the Protestant era and grounded the principles of the medical profession. Again, I refer to Thomas Sydenham, the leading British physician of the 1600s. He championed Hippocratic empirical medicine. The principles of the oath were unquestioned, but as will be evident from the following excerpt from his writings, the rationale for such behavior was based on Christian belief. It becomes every man who purposes to give himself to the care of others seriously to consider the following things. First, that he must one day give an account to the supreme judge of all. Secondly, that all his skill, knowledge, and energy should be exercised for God's glory. And thirdly, let him reflect that he has undertaken the care of no mean creature. He may estimate the value and greatness of the human race, the only begotten Son became himself a man and thus ennobled it with his divine dignity. During the 18th and 19th centuries, Hippocratic principles continued to underlie the ethics of Western medicine, even though religious and classical deontological ideas were being strongly challenged by rationalistic and utilitarian ethical thinkers. In medicine, Christian and Hippocratic principles prevailed into the 20th century. An example of this is found in one of the most famous physicians, Sir William Osler. Osler was a Canadian, son of British missionaries to Canada. He became a professor of medicine first at McGill, then Johns Hopkins, and finally in Oxford. He was and still is recognized for his influence on the development of clinical medicine, the conduct of physicians. Albert Johnson comments on the ethical leadership of Osler as follows. The decorum exemplified by this most beloved physician of all time was based on the simplest of deontologies, the golden rule and high moral ideals expressed in the Hippocratic Oath. Thus, Christianity, both Catholic and Protestant, played a major role in the development of medical ethics in Western healthcare. However, as we will discuss later, during the 20th century, ethics based on utility and personal autonomy shifted the ground of medical ethics. Third, and perhaps most obvious, is the role that Christianity played in the development of Western medicine is the nurture of compassionate care. I previously referred to Rodney Stark's suggestion that one of the important reasons for the rapid rise of Christianity in the first three centuries was health care provided by Christian communities. The Christian influence on the provision of compassionate care continued from medieval times to the 20th century, particularly in the establishment of hospitals, the development of the nursing profession, and worldwide introduction of medicine through missionary activity. David Lindbergh, in his book, The Beginning of Western Science, states that one of the most celebrated medieval achievements was the invention of the hospital. Medieval hospitals were religious foundations. Their origins seem to lie in the Byzantine Empire, expansion occurred during the Crusades in the 11th and 12th centuries by such organizations as the Hospitallers of St. John and the Knights Templar, who are famous these days in many books. By the 13th centuries, hospitals were established in most cities throughout Europe. The Christian influence on the development of hospitals continues to be evident today by the fact that many hospitals are named for their Christian origins, such as St. Bartholomew's, St. Paul's, Hollywood Presbyterian, and many Samaritan hospitals provide a few examples. With regard to nursing, as described by Roy Porter, the rise of trained nursing occurred in the 1700s and 1800s in Catholic orders, and such as the Daughters of Charity, Sisters of Mercy, and many Protestant orders, such as the Deaconess Institute. Particularly notable was the hospital at Kaiserswerth, Germany, where the icon of nursing, Florence Nightingale, was trained. The Christian tradition in nursing continued in much of Europe, and Roy Porter states that in the early 20th century, 8 out of every 9 nurses belonged to a Catholic or Protestant religious order. However, though Christianity strongly influenced the development of nursing, as the 20th century progressed, most nursing in Western hospitals came under secular control. Another important contributor to the growth of medical care was the mission movement. In his book, The Missionary Movement in Western History, Andrew Walls of the University of Edinburgh states, "The history of medical missions is an epiphenomenon of the medical profession. When Medical Missionary Society sent William Carey, its first missionary, to India in the 1800s, he was accompanied by a physician and a surgeon. Perhaps the most famous missionary explorer of all time, Dr. David Livingstone, was sent to Africa in the 1850s, studied medicine as part of his missionary training. I have a particular interest in missionary influence because my own grandfather was a missionary in Angola during the early 1900s. The reports I have read from such missionaries demonstrates their care for the people. their fight against the slave trade, and their efforts to bring education and health care. The concerns of missionaries provide a sharp contrast to the substantial Western exploitation that was taking place at the time. Christian medical missions have been involved in virtually every country in the world and have been a significant contributor to the fact that Western medicine became the medicine of the world. However, during the 20th century, a significant transformation took place. Changes include unparalleled advances in medical science and technology that basically have reshaped the ethics and delivery of health care. And in order to propose a Christian response to these changes, it's necessary for us to describe them. The advances in medical science and technology are evident to us, and many of them have been beneficial. I personally spent most of my medical career taking care of patients with kidney disease. One example of the many benefits of medical science that have arisen in the past 50 or 60 years is the fact that thousands of British Columbians alone are alive on dialysis or kidney transplant. However, also evidence to us is that this advancing technology provides serious social and moral problems. This issue is well described by Roy Porter at the conclusion of his book. The close of my history suggests that medicine's finest hour is the dawn of its greatest dilemmas. For centuries, medicine was impotent and thus unproblematic. From the Greeks to the First World War, the tasks were simple. It performed these with meager success. Today, with mission accomplished, its triumphs are dissolving into disorientation, inflated, unlimited, unfulfillable expectations. Medicine will have to redefine its limits even as it extends its capacities. Since the 1940s, a new bioethic has arisen, driven by a number of factors, including the advances of technology, some of which have the capacity to redefine the very meaning of humanness. The atrocities of the world wars, some of which were committed by doctors, a reformation in societal understanding of individual and human rights. This has led to a bioethics that increases the emphasis on individual choice versus the virtues of the healthcare provider. Also, there are those who advocate that bioethics should depart from the grounding of deontological principles of Western medicine and base ethical judgments on quantifiable utilitarian principles. The significance of such bioethical discussion and debate in our society is evidenced by the daily basis, by the fodder that it provides for television, printed media, and the movies. Radical changes in health technology and ethics have brought new challenges to the delivery of compassionate care. We are often confronted by examples where technology seems to be advancing and trumping healthcare. There are also significant issues concerning just distribution of healthcare resources and the individual rights to access care. In conclusion, I propose a Christian perspective on the relationship of Christian understandings and Western medicine today and into the future. The understandings do not directly address the many difficult issues that confront Western healthcare, but may provide a Christian approach. First of all, Christians will affirm the principal teachings of Jesus' life, the caring personhood of God, the high value of human beings, though not perfectible, made in the image of God, and the understanding that to love God is to serve others. Second, Christians today may understand medical science and technology in the way that most Judeo-Christian thinkers regarded it in the past. To quote Ecclesiasticus again, "Give the physician his place, for the Lord created him." There may be a time when your recovery lies in the hands of physicians. In the West, we are privileged to benefit from medical technology, and for the Christian, it is part of the fulfillment of Christ's mission to bring healing. Christians will welcome and participate in what has been called the greatest benefit of mankind. The advances of medical care may be thankfully received as arising from Christian thought and practice. Third, Christians will understand that healing is not the ultimate human goal or reality. The humanist philosopher Alan Harrington has written, "Death is an imposition on the human race and no longer acceptable. Humans must put an end to their own mortality as a consequence of being born." Christian wisdom does not conceive of this unrealistic concept, ultimately abolishing death. Such a goal would literally require the abolition of the laws of nature, including the laws of gravity. Jesus himself died, so the ultimate hope of Christian lies in the story of the resurrection. Christians are involved in healthcare not to eliminate the ultimate reality of death, but as profoundly illustrated in the Good Samaritan, to meet the present suffering of fellow human beings. Fourth, Christians may support the understanding by Margaret Somerville, director of the Center of Medical Ethics and Law at McGill University in 2006 Massey Lectures in a series entitled The Ethical Imagination. Somerville suggested that there are two possible responses to the breakthrough of the new technoscience. One is to abandon the science, and the other is to abandon the philosophical spiritual heritage. She states, "I believe it is a mistake to abandon either body of knowledge. Rather, we need a new vision that can facilitate the marriage of science and our philosophical spiritual heritage and support the continuance of that marriage." Early in my career, I read the words of a pioneering American cardiovascular surgeon, Michael DeBakey. "It is not possible to formulate a rigid ethical code that will embrace every circumstance and provide definitive moral directives for specific instances. Ethical decisions in medical science must therefore depend finally on the wisdom, compassion, integrity and compassion of the physician and his peers." I think the next thing is that Christians should appreciate that the emphasis on patient choice in medical ethics represents a Christian understanding. The political scientist Donald Tinder reminds us that the highest God-given human capacity is the liberty to choose for good or ill. That the Christian's primary role is not to coerce, but to be prophetic. Quoting from the book jacket, Tinder boldly challenges conventional wisdom, contending that Christianity requires no specific political program, but the prophetic stance judging all programs and institutions against the ideal of love for each individual. And so, in conclusion, Christianity is more than a philosophy. Being a Christian was and is not simply belief in a personal loving God or in human dignity. Christianity was and is about demonstrating compassionate care in the context of community. That's the message of the Good Samaritan. That's the basis of Christian compassion rooted in Western healthcare, and that will be the source of the Christian influence on healthcare into the future. Thank you.
very much indeed.
Dialogue is an important part of our meeting, so I would welcome now any questions or observations you'd like to direct to Bert. I'm sure
to start with observations. Yes.
You might be interested to know that.
Excuse me?
You might be interested to note that the University of Toledo is starting up its medical school again.
Oh, really?
That
is interesting, because apparently that was one of the first real medical schools. Yeah, that's good. Yes?
Has the concept of the sacredness of life, does that go back far? Has it been a powerful force? And is it something we should think about today?
Well, I think that there's a mixed story on that. I've taken the side that says that we should try to preserve life and that we should use medicine and so forth, quoting, for example, St. Basil. There were others who felt that this was not as critical, that the future life was more important. However, clearly the idea of the importance of life won out over the long term. So I would say in the early church, there was a sense that, you know, we were really looking for another land. So the idea of keeping people alive, and in fact there are quotations that say that we shouldn't exert a lot of energy keeping people alive. So there was definitely a mixed picture in the early church. The thing that amazes me, though, when I think about Christianity, is that yes, there's always been these nuances and shifts and so forth. But when you think about it, I understand that there's a movie coming out on William Wilberforce and the whole issue of slavery. Why? What was wrong with slavery? I mean, you know, why shouldn't some people be slaves and others be, you know, kings? I mean, that was such a realistic idea. And in fact, it didn't really bother people hugely, and yet the seed of the whole idea of the individual and the importance of the individual rose up through the Christian church. So again, the answer is not very clear, but I think there are two sides to that coin from Christian perspective. I'm always nervous about people, and I can tell you I want to speak very humbly. Because quite honestly, when any of us are confronted by these things in our own lives, it's a lot different than talking about them theoretically. But I'm always nervous about people who seem to want to expend any sort of energy to keep themselves alive when they're Christians, because that isn't, there's supposed to be another side to our being a Christian. I don't think that answers the question, but maybe it's helpful. Yes?
I'm playing the devil's advocate over here a little bit on the sanctity of life thing. I do think that the tradition has been that you don't go to extremes is what you're talking about, to keep people alive.
Right.
But one of the things that characterized the early Christians was that they didn't expose their infants, and the Roman law said that one of the things they did was that they exposed infants, and disabled infants were definitely exposed, and that they caused quite a stir within the Roman Empire, because the people were saying, well, what are we going to do with these Christians? Not only do they not expose their own infants and they not cause deliberate death, but they rescue the children of other people that are out there. So there, although they may not have prolonged life, there definitely was not what we see today in our secular culture, a push for deliberate killing and taking of life. There was a preservation of life, at least from that.
You know, I agree with you entirely, Margaret. Thanks for bringing that up. Yes, Carl.
Going back to the earlier comment, I wonder if Phil had this in mind, there's a big distinction or a major difference between a life fulfilled in an afterlife and a life that has no meaning intrinsically.
Yeah.
Christians may have felt that the life fulfilled in the afterlife was the fulfillment and culmination of life, but that didn't trivialize life.
No, I don't. I think you're right, but there certainly, I mean, there were people in the early church who didn't think you should even do medicine. I mean, there were some groups. I mean, there's been a wide spectrum of Christian thought. What we are observing is what has come through to us. But there were different ways that people approach things. But I will agree, though, with Margaret says, that the thing that characterized the early church was things like the preservation of infants. And again, you could ask why. I mean, it must have been their philosophy, because from a utilitarian point of view, that's why they exposed infants. And was because they didn't want to have the burden in society. So Christians obviously took this on, and so the early church, I mean, I'm not belittling this, the church always was against abortion, for example, but so were many Greco-Romans. I mean, there were a lot of reasons for being against this, including intrinsic value of the individual. There were also property rights involved, and but it's quite interesting that there's one Roman before Galen. Just trying to think, I'm probably going to pronounce his first name wrong, so I'll only give you a second, called Largus, who basically went to Hippocrates as justification for opposing abortion in the first century. So it wasn't only Christians who saw this as an important issue, but it certainly was mostly Christians. And that's why the Christians could take this element of Greco-Roman thought and bring it into the Christian church. Yes?
You mentioned that the infant choice is a Christian ideal, and that the role of the Christian tradition is not to force the radical to be prophetic. What do you mean by prophetic?
By what, sorry?
Prophetic.
Good question. Here I am really quoting from a political philosopher, Christian political philosopher, who's actually spoken at UBC, and he has a book called The Political Meaning of Christianity. And basically how he would describe the prophetic stance has a few things. That God is unfolding history. And so that's one of the views. That there's a simultaneous exaltation and fallenness of individuals, and that we are open, communally open to society. So the idea of the prophetic stance really is it's a witnessing stance. And so the job is not, and this is, I mean, this is his view. There are others who would take this differently, but the job is not to impose an ideology. His view is that whenever you try to impose an ideology, power always corrupts. So his view is that Christianity is always a problem because it doesn't impose an ideology. It brings love into the situation. And so it won't be good for the right and it won't be good for the left. And when you impose those ideologies where people think they're making a perfect world, it won't work. Because we're not perfect people. Not the people we serve, not ourselves. So we always come with humility, recognizing that some of the choices we make will be wrong. We can't know. We can't judge those choices, ultimately. We take the principles, we trust that we're being led by the Spirit, but ultimately it's not an ideology that we're talking about. It's the principle of a loving God, and that God is unfolding history, and that we're part of that process. So that's, I think that, does that explain that?
Okay. Yes?
Yeah.
The role of the church involved in that,
yeah,
rather than just the individual, and in light of the fact that the current system is influenced by secular values of
right.
Power and authority and
yeah.
Financial restrictions.
Well, that's a very good question. One of the things that impressed me about 5 years ago or 6 years ago is when I traveled to Turkey and Greece and realized that the church was founded there, and you can find very few Christians. And what it said to me is that we don't really have control of that. I mean, basically, Christianity moved from that area and largely and moved into Europe, and now has moved into North America, but may ultimately be going to Africa and South America. We don't, that's the whole part of the idea of the prophetic stance. God controls history. We do our thing. If Christians do their thing, I can tell you they will influence the world. I mean, if Christians really love, and you know, there is power in that, then the church will have a tremendous impact on what is going to happen in the future. But we don't have control of that. And so that's why I left that fairly vague. I mean, if we live the Good Samaritan principle within the church, and I think, frankly, we have to start within the church. I mean, we can talk about all this moral theory, but what's actually happening in the church? If it's not happening there, it's not going to happen in the rest of the world, no matter what we say. So I think it has a very important role, but I can't predict it. Yes?
Some of the things that you said about Western medicine involved with its ability, you talked about it being a gift in human kind and how it's kind of mobilizable and able to spread. And you didn't talk about, because you didn't have time, of course, what's outside of that. You were talking about Western medicine, but I think the title implies that there's something else. And it seems to me that this globalizing spread you're talking about is sometimes exactly the kind of imposition of power that you were saying Christianity doesn't encourage. Because whenever Western medicine spreads, it's at the expense of something else. There's nowhere where medicine isn't, or nowhere where medicine hasn't been. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the ways that Western medicine has taken over or has erased some other kinds of things.
Okay. Well, first of all, you have to believe that Western medicine is a benefit. I mean, if you don't believe that, then it's not a great gift. But the point is that if you look at, I guess I see it from the point of view of dealing with it. And Western medicine does amazing things. I mean, our life expectancy has gone within the last 50, 60 years has gone from an average of 60 to up to over an average of 80. I mean, it's just been a huge demographic shift. Now, so if that's a benefit, then it's been Western medicine that's done that. Now, there are other kinds of medicine, and quite frankly, given the time and the scope, I really didn't look a lot into them. I mean, Roy Porter's book has a chapter on Hindu medicine, chapter on Chinese medicine, and so forth. But the fact is that because Western medicine is uniquely powerful, it has gone into all of these areas. There isn't a place that you go to in Africa that doesn't have a Western hospital. Now, there's other kinds of medicine being practiced, but I would suspect the most effective is Western, because it's basically scientific medicine. So certainly there are other kinds of medicine, but you know, I don't think they have been as effective, and that's why people turn to it in the end. Yes? The way society is shifting away. Well, I think really we're sort of going back to the first century in my thinking. I mean, I think Christians may be called upon to make choices that they didn't have to make. I don't think we should feel that we're protected if we decide that we take certain stands. We are protected right now in our society. Things cut both ways. I mean, we are given tremendous liberty in our society to be Christians. That could go. I mean, I was thinking on the issue of abortion. There are worse states, and may still be states, that actually mandate abortion. after you've had a certain number of children. So we have a lot of freedom in the West both ways, both secularly and as Christians. That may not always be the case, but now it is, and I think that basically we have to stand up for what we believe, but I don't know that that will always be guaranteed, and that freedom will always be guaranteed. And certainly, as I say, it cuts both ways. If we are free, that's the other thing about the point Tinder makes. The highest God allows people to reject him. God allowed Jesus to die. So that is an intrinsic reality in our faith. So that if people choose to reject God, we don't have the right to dominate them, but we do have the prophetic voice. That's the thought. Yep.
Maybe one of the things to respond to that is that Hippocrates and his followers did not impose their views on anyone. They stated what their ethical code was. That they wouldn't kill you even if the guy, in Hippocrates' day, you didn't know whether the doctor was going to kill you or not because the guy who dated you down the street paid more money than you did, then he would lead you in. So Hippocrates, part of his code was, he said, I won't do that. And neither will my followers. So people voted with their feet. They said, see, someone who has this understanding that he's accountable to someone greater than himself and then all of the other things that Bert outlined, I want to go to somebody like that. And I think as Christians, we have that same opportunity if Western medicine, as we know it, disintegrates to the place where it becomes very utilitarian and consumeristic, that if it comes to the place where we need to make a parallel system, that people will choose to vote with their feet and come to it. But we do have that choice to be prophetic. I think another word for prophetic is just speaking God's word. Yeah. And if we speak his word into our society, into our community, and offer that to people the way the Samaritan did, then people are going to choose to come to us, the ones that we can't read. So I don't think anything has ever shackled someone from providing that kind of care. It's just what the context that you're going to be able to do it in.
Mm-hmm. Good. One more. Yes?
Yeah, I know this is sort of different subject, but we're talking about Western medicine.
Yes. Right. Well, you see, that's one of the difficulties of being scientists, right? The point about Western medicine is simply that it is empirical. That you set up a study, you look at the results, and you analyze the results, and you take a conclusion. Any type of medicine that does that fits that norm. Now, if somebody says, if I give you 2 drops of X, you'll have Y, and has no proof for that whatsoever, except that patient X says, well, I felt better, doctor, thanks very much, then I don't personally have a huge problem with that, because feeling better is the object. But Western medicine is empirical medicine, and that's the point about it. And maybe it's not a good term, but it's the term that basically that, and that's why Porter tried to describe that. Yes, there are different ways of healing and so forth, but empirical medicine has a very specific foundation, albeit it can be weak too, because experiments show one thing, another set of experiments show the other. So it's not always so simple as that. But you can see by the progress that has been made, incredible progress. If you look at just what I said, thousands of people today in this province live on dialysis and transplants. Okay? And that's amazing. Now, whether that's good or not, I guess it depends on your point of view. But that is definitely the result of empirical medicine. So that's what I'm talking about when I talk about Western medicine.
There's one last question over
here. Yes? Right.
So there's that aspect there is like, so for the future of Western medicine today, will it look, do you think that you go back to this initial approach as well, that there's actually a not only is there a physical, but there's also a spiritual side that, you know, that has not, that Western medicine has gone away from, and that we become very rigorous and empirical, as you say, but the original Christian influence has a spiritual aspect.
I think that's a very good point. I don't see it in the future particularly. I see it as a potential for Christians. In terms of healing, you know, there's always been, that's a whole other tradition of healing. And that's always been there in, it was there in non-Christian as well as in Christian, and it's always been there through the Christian era as well. The thing, I just want to make a comment though, I'm sort of taking your question tangentially. I think that, you know, this really is the point, that I think Christianity had an awful lot to do, and I've tried to make the point, with the rise of Western medicine. And I think that this is part of the fulfillment of the kingdom, and that we're part of that. Now, the fact that there may be other elements, or the fact that spiritual healing is needed as well, I don't disagree with that at all. But I become very nervous when Christians kind of go, get treated by something that somebody invested huge amounts of money into, huge amounts of effort into, and say, well, God healed me. Well, God did heal them. But so it was done through a lot of doctors, a lot of nurses, a lot of companies, a lot of this, a lot of that. And I think we need to find our balance in that. And if we can see Western medicine as part of the fulfillment of the kingdom, then I think we can accept that better. And I don't say at all that God wasn't part of that, because that's the tradition that I've pulled it from the Jewish tradition. But I just think we need to have a balance in that and be realistic about it. That's all. Yeah. David.
Thank you very much indeed. I think the sustained nature of the conversation here shows not only the importance of the issues you've raised, Bert, and the breadth of their range, but I think it's also the graciousness with which you presented them. So I do want to thank you very much on behalf of the Forum. You have been a good friend of the Forum for many years, and we would like just to make this a small offering to you. And thank you very much indeed for your presentation.
Okay.